So in our study of the book of Proverbs, we come to the theme of money. And if you would like a text, I suggest Proverbs 10, verse 22. The blessing of the Lord brings wealth, and he adds no trouble to it. The song says, money is the root of all evil, which I guess is what many people think the Bible says about it. Actually, of course, it's a misquotation. What the Apostle Paul really said was, the love of money is the root of all evil, which of course is a very different thing. The Bible actually has a very positive attitude towards wealth, really. Doesn't despise it in the least. Indeed, the book of Proverbs is quite convinced that financial prosperity is part of being successful in life, and as such is a perfectly legitimate aspiration. Solomon's very candid about the advantages that wealth brings to a person. For instance, in chapter 10, verse 15, near to our text, he describes the security that it brings. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city, he says, but poverty is the ruin of the poor. And if that sounds far too unspiritual and worldly to our taste, perhaps it's because our spirituality is the middle-class sort that's never had an empty stomach. No one who's ever visited Calcutta, for instance, can doubt how miserable real poverty is. Sir Henry Ward Beecher observed once, poverty may be very good in a poem, it's very bad in a house. Chapter 18, verse 23, conveys a similar realism about the weakness of the poor man's position in society. Solomon says, a poor man pleads for mercy, but a rich man answers harshly. See, no matter how egalitarian the system, the man who depends upon the largesse of others is going to get the thick end of any stick that's being waved. He who pays the piper calls the tune. Money talks, we say. Now Solomon would agree with that kind of realism. So in common with his practical, not to say pragmatic attitude, he sees money as definitely having its uses. And so he has a lot of advice about avoiding poverty and achieving wealth. That's perhaps worth taking note of, especially those of us who are in the wage-earning bracket. One thing he encourages a lot is industriousness. For instance, he says in chapter 21, verse 17, that self-indulgence is a sure route to the workhouse. He who loves pleasure will become poor, he said. Whoever loves wine and oil will never be rich. 23, verse 21, similarly, drunkards and gluttons become poor. Drowsiness clothes them in rags. Some of us perhaps can remember the music halls. I don't know. Not that we'd ever go to one. But I'm told that the music halls used to make a comic sketch out of the drunkards, sort of swinging from the lampposts, singing drunk songs. Well, I suppose it may seem a bit funny to people being entertained, but anybody who's really seen the ruin that debauchery and alcoholism brings into a life, I think is unlikely to really find it very funny. Self-indulgence is not a route to prosperity. Neither, says Solomon, is idleness. Perhaps not, that's not an unrelated source of financial ruin in some ways, certainly one which Proverbs criticizes a great deal. For instance, in chapter 6, verse 10, I like this one very much. Conjures up a picture in the mind. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands in rest, and poverty will come upon you like a bandit, scarcity like an armed man. We may talk about the idle rich. According to Proverbs, they're not rich for very long. Interestingly, though, the opposite of work, according to Solomon, is not always laziness. It's possible to dissipate your energies in other kinds of fruitless ways, too. Speculating for gold, for instance, when you could be planting corn. Like in chapter 28, verse 19. He who works his land will have abundant food, but he who chases fantasies will have his fill of poverty. Text perhaps that ought to be inscribed on the wall of every teenage son who wants to be a football professional or a pop star. Not wrong, of course, to take advantages of opportunities to improve one's status, but harebrained get-rich-quick schemes are, in Solomon's view, generally a recipe for disaster. He says in chapter 20, 21, an inheritance quickly gained at the beginning will not be blessed at the end. So you see, easy money is usually unreliable. Now, as a general rule, work is a much more sure way to prosperity than bright ideas. So industriousness, that's the first thing Solomon's very keen on. The second thing he feels is very important is sound business sense. Solomon has a lot of shrewd comments about this, because obviously the person who lacks it, no matter how hard working he may be, is likely to finish up on the breadline just as much as if he'd been lazy all the time. I think this is really the intended force of 13:23. It's an ambiguous proverb. What it literally says is, a poor man's field may produce an abundance of food, but lack of judgment sweeps it away. Now, the NIV interprets lack of judgment as meaning injustice. In other words, the courts don't successfully defend this man's right of property. So he loses all the benefit, all the profit he should rightly have got from his field. But I think more likely, Solomon means that even a viable business will make a loss if the person who manages it is incompetent, lacks judgment. There are many ways that lack of business sense shows. A waste of resources, for instance. We have a saying, don't we? A fool and his money are soon parted. Solomon has a similar sentiment in 17, verse 16. Of what use, he asks, is money in the hands of a fool, since he doesn't desire to get wisdom? Spurgeon comments on that verse, any idiot can make money, it takes a wise man to spend it. He's right, waste of resources is responsible for a great deal of hardship. I suppose in line with that, Solomon is a great believer in savings. 13, verse 11. He who gathers money little by little makes it grow, he says. 21, verse 20. In the house of the wise are stores, reserves. But the foolish man devours all he's got. It was Maynard Keynes, wasn't it, the economist, who made the famous dictum during the Depression that anybody who saved 5 shillings was putting a man out of work for a day. And I suppose it's ever since his time that this sort of spend, spend, spend philosophy espoused by governments and therefore ultimately by individuals has gripped our society. Well, I don't think Solomon would be frightfully impressed by it. Economists may try and persuade us that the answer to every economic problem is more and more spending. But Solomon seems to feel that to spend too much is a recipe for long-term economic disaster, not prosperity. Savings are important, he says. But enthusiasm for savings mustn't suppress wise investment. He has something to say about that too. In 14, verse 4. Now this is a rather cryptic proverb, which many have trouble understanding. Let me read it to you. It says, where there are no oxen, the manger is empty. But from the strength of an ox comes an abundant harvest. Now, some people feel this is a warning about what you might call sterile neatness. Everything, it says, may be clean and tidy in a barn if there are no cows there, but it doesn't imply prosperity. A certain measure of disorganization, therefore, is an evidence of productiveness rather than mismanagement. Well, I think that's rather a pleasing thought. Perhaps I should try it on my wife the next time she complains about the untidiness of my office. But I think actually the real sense of the proverb is more likely along the lines that a business which is going somewhere must expect running costs. If you wanted to paraphrase it in contemporary situation, you might say, a farm without tractors will have a low fuel bill, but mechanization increases production. I think there is such a thing as a false economy. And reducing your oxen in order to save fodder is a classic example. One business practice which Solomon definitely feels is unwise is borrowing, and particularly borrowing on security. Chapter 22, verse 26 to 27, is all about this. Do not be a man who strikes hand in pledge, as he would say, shakes hands on it, or puts up security for debts. Why? Because if you lack the means to pay, the very bed will be snatched from under you. Very obvious point, no doubt one which hire purchase companies would prefer not to be spread abroad too loudly. Mind you, I've never really understood this business of borrowing on security. It seems to me the basic principle of credit is that they're willing to lend you if you can prove to them that you don't need it. So exhortations to industriousness and advice on simple business sense and management. Solomon's got all these things. I suppose they're elements of financial prudence which you might call obvious and expected in a book of sanctified common sense like this is. And yet, you know, there are other emphases on this subject of money within Proverbs which are more surprising, and I think which reveal a much more overtly spiritual and moral tone than many other subjects Solomon deals with. One thing that interests me in this regard is the way Solomon repudiates class prejudice on the base of wealth. Now, Solomon is very frank about the power situation which an unequal distribution of capital creates in a society. For instance, in 22, verse 7, I think it is, the rich rule over the poor. The borrower is servant of the lender, he says. It's an observation, I'm sure, which Marx would have had no difficulty at all in agreeing with. But the thing is, Solomon refuses to accept that that observation about life implies an inevitable class war. His response to that kind of antagonism between rich and poor is, in fact, deeply theological. He has four quite deep points in response to it. One hinges on the doctrine of creation. In 22, verse 2, he says this: rich and poor have this in common. The Lord is the maker of them both. In other words, our joint humanity is a far more fundamental solidarity than any class loyalty deriving from considerations of wealth. Another argument he uses comes from the doctrine of man in chapter 14, verse 31. He who oppresses the poor, he says, shows contempt for their maker. Now, how do you show contempt for God by oppressing the poor? Surely only one way. Because man is the image bearer of God. Man has a value and a dignity, irrespective of how much money he's got in the bank, because he bears God's image. And so to oppress the poor man is to insult God. That's what Jesus was getting at when he said, inasmuch as you do it to one of these, you do it to me. Third argument that Solomon uses against the class war in this business of riches and poverty is the doctrine of providence. In chapter 29, verse 13, the poor man and his oppressor have this in common: the Lord gives sight to the eyes of both of them. In other words, how ridiculous it is for creatures so totally and constantly dependent on the sustaining mercy of God to take advantage of one another's minor inequalities. It's ridiculous. And the fourth argument he uses against class warfare is the doctrine of judgment. In chapter 22, verse 22. Do not exploit the poor because they're poor, he says. Why? Because the Lord will take up their case and will plunder those who plunder them. See, a man who believes in God finds he has a moral sanction against economic injustice. Revolution is necessary only for atheists who've got no final court of appeal except the machine gun. But a man who believes in a God of judgment can be patient. That's one little insight that shows that Solomon's attitude to wealth is not quite so mercenary as maybe you might think from all these this talk about being industrious and earning money as well you can. Another little emphasis, which I think shows the same thing, is his persistent emphasis on contentment. For instance, in chapter 23, verses 4 and 5, he says there, "Don't wear yourself out to get rich." I like that rendering of it. "Have the wisdom to show restraint," he says. Because a lot of people do wear themselves out getting rich, don't they? He says, look, it's not worth the heart attacks and the ulcers and the mental exhaustion it's going to cost you. Why? Because, he says, prosperity is elusive. You just take a glance at riches and they're gone. They've sprouted wings and flown off like an eagle. No, don't wear yourself out to get rich. 14:30, he says, "A contented heart gives life to the body, but envy, the lust for more, rots the bones." Last week we came across Agur, the wise man who occurs at the end of Proverbs in chapter 30, and he has something rather revealing, I think, to say about poverty and riches. In 30 verse 8, he says, "Please don't give me either poverty or riches. Just give me my daily bread. Otherwise," he says, "I may have too much and disown you, God, and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or on the other hand," he says, "I may become poor and steal, and so dishonor the name of my God." In other words, be satisfied with necessities. Luxury leads to spiritual complacency. Poverty leads to the temptation to dishonesty. So says Agur, far better to simply be content, like that book that's out these days, Enough is Enough, he says. Contentment, then. A third little emphasis which Solomon has, which shows that really he's far more spiritual in his attitude to money than some people may give him credit for, is his insistence that money can't buy you everything. It can't buy you, for instance, he says, a good conscience. 15 verse 16. "Better a little with fear of the Lord than great wealth and turmoil." I suppose he means internal turmoil of conscience, because a man who doesn't fear the Lord is in terror of judgment. Can't buy you a good conscience. Can't buy you family affection either, he says in 15:17. "Better a meal of vegetables where there is love than a fattened calf with hatred." Can't buy you an honorable reputation either, 22 verse 1. "A good name is more desirable than great riches. To be esteemed is better than silver or gold," he says. And perhaps most characteristic of all of our day, he says, "Money can't buy you peace and quiet." 17 verse 1. "Better a dry crust with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife." What was it the Beatles used to sing? "Money can't buy you love." Well, it's true. In fact, money can't buy you an awful lot of things. The most important things in life, money can't buy you. It may buy you a bed, but it won't buy you sleep. It may buy you books, but it won't buy you brains. It may buy you food, but it won't buy you an appetite. It used to be able to buy you a master's, but it couldn't buy you a bachelor's. It may buy you medicine, but it won't buy you health. Might buy you cosmetics, but not beauty. Amusement, but not happiness. Have enough that you might even buy the earth, but you won't buy heaven. "It may win you a few friends," says Solomon. "But they'll be fair weather friends, certainly. You can be quite sure that they'll be off once you lose your money." 19 verse 4. "Wealth brings many friends, yes, but a poor man's friends desert him," he says. There are, of course, situations where to have a little money in the bank can get you out of a jam. But even then, says Solomon, it's arguably a mixed blessing. 13 verse 8. "A man's riches may ransom his life, but then a poor man hears no threat," he says. In other words, you wouldn't have been kidnapped in the first place if you hadn't been rolling in it, says Solomon. No, money doesn't bring you friends. It just gives you a better class of enemies. Perhaps that's why he observes in 13 verse 7, the preceding verse, that people are not always what they seem as far as money goes. One man pretends to be rich and yet has nothing. Another pretends to be poor and yet has great wealth. In fact, you can see the same man playing both these tricks. The first time when he goes into the bank for his overdraft, pretending to be rich yet having nothing. The second time when he goes into the Social Security office after his supplementary benefit, pretending to be poor yet having great wealth. Otherwise, it's not always wise to let on exactly what you've got. And what's more, he says, if there's a real calamity, wealth is quite impotent to rescue you anyway. 11 verse 4. Wealth is worthless in the day of wrath. When real trouble strikes a society, what's the first thing that happens? Inflation. Mammoth inflation. Right? Like they had in Germany after the war, you know, when great fistfuls of money couldn't buy you a loaf of bread. They saw it in Uganda recently too. It's always the first thing that happens. Money's useless. When wrath really strikes, can't do anything. What's your only hope in such a situation? Why, says Solomon 11 verse 4, righteousness may deliver you from death. That's the only thing that's any use in that situation. And the same emphasis on righteousness being a more dependable security than a bank balance is found in 11:28. Whoever trusts in riches will fall, he says. But the righteous will thrive like a green leaf. Riches may be a blessing then, but they're no panacea for every problem in life. The man who relies upon them too heavily is going to be let down. And then, of course, that's one of the occupational hazards of the wealthy, to think that their checkbook is an answer to everything. Solomon recognizes that in chapter 18, verse 11. The wealth of the rich, he says, is their fortified city. They imagine it to be an unscalable wall. The key word there, of course, is imagine. They imagine it. You compare that false security with the genuine article in the preceding proverb in 18 verse 10. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. Now, there's no getting away from it. Righteousness, all things considered, is a much better investment than gilt-edged stocks, says Solomon. But of course, it doesn't have to be an either-or. Solomon is kind enough to tell us that. There are, in fact, many clear statements in Proverbs that indicate that wealth can be a reward for the righteous. Like in 15, verse 16, the house of the righteous contains great treasure, he says. He doesn't say in that verse that the wicked don't get rich. He says the income of the wicked brings them trouble. In other words, ill-gotten gain is more trouble than it's worth. And that's a repeated sentiment in different forms all the way through. In 10 verse 2, ill-gotten treasures are of no value. On 21 verse 6, a fortune made by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and a deadly snare. Solomon really does believe, you see, that honesty is the best policy and that thieves never prosper. 22:4, humility and the fear of the Lord bring wealth and honor in life. Now, can he really mean that? Well, he's not talking about spiritual prosperity, you see. Often when we read Jesus' words about treasure and so on, he's clearly talking about spiritual blessings and spiritual treasure. Lay up treasure in heaven, he says. Solomon is not doing that. He really does believe that ultimately the meek inherit not heaven, but earth. That's quite a thought, isn't it? Misfortune pursues the sinner, he says, but prosperity is the reward of the righteous. 13 verse 21. Mind you, he's honest enough to admit that sometimes it takes more than one generation for retribution to catch up with that bad man and his money. A good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children, but a sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous. Sometimes it takes a long while for the sinner's wealth to find its hands into the righteous. One reason, I guess, for this connection that Solomon sees between wealth and righteousness is that people use money according to their character. It's not that sort of bad money has some kind of curse attaching to it, but that evil men will put their money to bad uses and pay the price for it. And that's what he's getting at in 10 verse 16. The wages of the righteous bring them life, he says, but the income of the wicked brings them punishment. It's the way they use their wealth that brings the consequences. But there is a deeper and a more spiritual reason why wealth and morality should be connected, and that brings us back to the text we began with in 10:22. It is, he says, the blessing of the Lord that brings wealth, and he adds no trouble to it. There's an emphatic pronoun in that text there. The blessing of the Lord, it brings wealth. In other words, no other source of genuine wealth is there. And the mark of the wealth which the Lord gives, as opposed to ill-gotten gain, is that it is trouble-free. He adds no trouble to it. Now, this recognition that it's the Lord who ultimately makes men prosperous is what lies, I think, behind Solomon's fifth spiritual emphasis, if you like, in regard to money. And that is the importance of open-handed liberality. Solomon says there's something paradoxical about the distribution of money in this world. It doesn't go to the people who hoard it at all. It goes to the people who give it away. Meanness, for instance, he says, far from increasing a man's wealth, diminishes it. 28 verse 22. A stingy man may be eager to get rich, but he's unaware, he says, that poverty awaits him. Conversely, he says, generosity, far from eroding a man's wealth, actually enhances it. In 11:25. A generous man will prosper. He who refreshes others will himself be refreshed. Solomon applies this, I think, in two areas which are particularly important for us. The one is the care of the poor. He says about the care of the poor that exploitation is in the long run counterproductive. 28 verse 8. He who increases his wealth by exorbitant interest amasses it for another person who's going to be kind to the poor. It's counterproductive in the long run, you see. A generous man, he says, will be blessed because he shares his food with the poor. Solomon's quite convinced that giving is good for you. That to be charitable, to be kind towards other people, to share what we have, doesn't reduce our prosperity, but increases it. I think that's a very important lesson for us to learn, you know, in these days of the welfare state. I greatly admire the achievements of the welfare state in reducing poverty. You only need to compare what Britain is like today with what it was like 100 years ago to realise that great achievements have been made through that kind of social benefits. And yet, you know, there is a very serious problem about our welfare state. And that is, it robs us of the opportunity for charity. And because it robs us of the opportunity for charity, it actually robs us of blessing. A society which knows charity, which knows generosity, has a blessing which a society which can't give freely in that way doesn't know. Jesus says it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's quite true that we pay our taxes, and the Bible commands us to pay our taxes, but the Bible never attributes any spiritual benefit to acts of civil obedience in the way that it attributes them to acts of generosity. Now, I think we ought to be looking for ways to be charitable. Solomon says there's a blessing attached to it. And the other area where this perception that it's the Lord who ultimately gives wealth comes out very clearly in a practical way in Proverbs is in the imperative of stewardship, which Solomon states in chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Famous words these, for those who know Proverbs at all. Honour the Lord with your wealth, he says, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. So you can't outgive God. In the Old Testament, he appointed these tithes, these first fruits, as a method of supporting the Levites and the priests. But he didn't appoint it, says Solomon, as a burdensome duty, as something that ought to be given grudgingly and resentfully because it diminishes us. He says he appointed it as a joyful privilege and as a pathway to blessing. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing and your vats will brim over with new wine. We ought to feel that way surely too in these days of new covenant about giving. Why, says Paul, the Lord loves a cheerful giver. And if you know the story that was told of a Roman Catholic and a Pentecostalist and a Scottish Presbyterian who were talking about how much they give to God. Have I told this one before? Oh, I told it at Kikyu, didn't I? Oh, well, never mind. The congregation will enjoy. And the Roman Catholic said, when he was asked how much he gives to God, well, he says, my priest tells me I should give a tenth, so that's what I do. The Pentecostalist replied, well, I pray, and I decide how much the Holy Spirit is leading me to give. And the Scottish Presbyterian said, well, you see, it's like this. I put all my money in the offertory plate, and I throw it up in the air, and what the Lord wants, he keeps. But it's always unfair on the Scottish that we tell stories like that about them. And I'm sure they're not the only ones, or if they are even ones. Who are sometimes resentful about parting with a shilling. We shouldn't be, you see. This is God's appointed way to support the ministry, and it's a pathway to blessing, says Solomon. There are, of course, alternative ways that money could be raised. Some churches go into the property business and finance their activities out of rents. Some churches go into the gambling business and finance their activities out of lotteries and whist drives. Some churches go into the entertainment business and finance themselves from sales of tickets and hiring their church premises and such like. Some churches go into the births, marriages and deaths business, finance themselves out of fees for such ceremonies. Some churches depend on kindergartens and, well, all kinds of things. There are many ways churches could finance themselves. But there's only one biblical way, you see. The tithes and the offerings of God's people. Honour the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of your crops. Why does the Lord appoint it that way? Why? Because there is a blessing attached to doing it that way, which there is not to do it any other way. To do it any other way is for God's people to miss the blessing of giving. To the unconverted, money is a means of gratification. But to the person who surrendered his life to Christ, it is a means of grace. To the one, it's an opportunity for comfort. To the other, it's an opportunity for consecration. It's better to give, said Jesus, than to receive. And for once, we can have absolutely no doubt about the fact that Solomon agrees with Jesus. Let's pray together.